This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The mass shooting that killed more than 24 people at a church in rural Texas over the weekend was the latest in a string of such shootings in this country. From Texas to Las Vegas to Charleston and Newtown, mass shootings shock and outrage Americans for various reasons.
But writer Gary Young says there is another trend that should be just as disturbing: the deaths of children from gun violence every day. Young is Black, British, of Barbadian descent, and his wife is African-American. He covered the U.S. for more than a decade for the Guardian newspaper, for which he is now editor-at-large back in Britain.
His recent book is called Another Day in the Death of America. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about it, and Young says it's the regularity of gun violence that he sees in this country that had always been difficult to explain elsewhere, but it was having two African-American children that crystallized the need for him to tell the stories that he does in this book.
I think having two kids in America anyway, if you're not from America, would alert you. You know, the gun that washed up beside my son's school in Chicago, we lived in Chicago for 4 years, or the shootout near his daycare. Those would have happened whatever race we were. Being Black just raised the odds. And, I mean, one of the things that struck me writing this book was every single Black parent that I spoke to thought this could happen to their child. The mother in Dallas said, I didn't think it would be him, I thought it would be his brother. The father in Newark said, you're not doing your job as a Black father if you don't think your child could be shot in Newark. So there is that extra burden because of those extra odds.
The other thing that struck me with this book is the way you decided to explore the topic. You picked a day and you tried to find everyone, every child who had been shot that day. Why that particular structure?
I was keen, by picking a day and then allowing the day to choose the cases and therefore not gaming it, that if I'd picked a different day, I would have a different book. And I was actually particularly insistent, even though in some ways, as a reader, it would be easier if I didn't do this, that the children come in the order in which they're shot, which means the first chapter is in many ways the hardest. It's the youngest child, 9 years old. He answers the door, his mother's ex-partner shoots him in the head, and then runs away and is eventually shot in a shootout with the police. I would not have started with that chapter if I wanted to pace people's emotional kind of engagement with the book, but I was adamant not to game it. And so this is the day, this is how they fell, because to me the power and the conceit is, if this book takes you a week to finish, well, then there'll be pretty much 50 kids will be dead in that week. And this is just the day as I found it. And I took the day at random.
And so those stories are there. It just, whose stories it happens to be that day.
Well, that's it. The next thing about that conceit is really journalistic, that these are happening in plain sight every day. And we are taught, I was taught in journalism school, you know, dog bites man is not a story, man bites dog is a story. And there's a way in which these are dog bites man stories, and that sooner or later you have to ask yourself, who owns these dogs? And why do the same people keep being bitten? And what can we do to stop this happening? There is something about the way that these deaths happen here and the way in which the country has become inured to them, well, that just happens. And so long as they happen in a certain way, in certain places, to certain people, then it becomes the kind of white noise that everybody can be used to. Every now and then the country is kind of concretized by a mass shooting, but these do not make the headlines. And so that was the other journalistic kind of drive in this pursuit, was to tell stories that aren't told.
The media, as you say, in the country doesn't report these deaths. They happen so often. There might be one or two lines in a newspaper. What role does American journalism play in continuing this cycle?
Well, to be fair, you know, journalism can't be understood outside of the context of society. So there are things that are going on in Britain that are, you know, I wouldn't even know what they are because I'm British. It would take an, you know, it was, if you wanted to know what was going on in Ireland, you didn't read a British newspaper in the 60s. You would have read the Boston Globe or the New York Times or whatever they were, you know. There was some good reporting from Britain, but by and large, outsiders just will see things that you don't see. And it doesn't mean they're always right. It's not really about being right. It's just having a sort of different gaze. And so it's not just journalism. I think American society doesn't see these deaths. They're mostly poor. They are disproportionately black and brown. So they don't see these people. They don't see these lives. So why would they see these deaths? You know, when Katrina happened, and then suddenly all of these poverty and this, it was washed up, and people were kind of like, well, you know, where the hell did that come from? Or Black Lives Matter, that it's not that more people are being killed by the police, it's that we are now paying attention to something that's been going on for a while. And so it speaks to a broader problem of race and class. Now, these are problems that every society has. It's just that the one thing that no other Western society has is guns on this scale.
When you were doing the research to learn about the lives of these children who were killed, were people talking to you about Second Amendment? Because that comes up so much here, whether you are pro-gun or anti-gun or whatever it is in this, and there are a lot of people in this country who are very anti-gun and would like to see the kinds of restraints on them that you have in Britain, that you have in Canada, that you have in Australia. Mm. So were people talking about it in those ways?
It was one of the oddest things to me. It never came up. The Second Amendment never came up. Actually, guns barely came up. I would ask each family the open-ended question. 10 kids died that day, were shot dead that day, and I would speak to, I reached 8 kin, and I would ask them, well, what do you think this is about? Not a single one mentions guns. And I assume that it's a bit like traffic, that if your child was run over, you wouldn't think, well, we must get rid of traffic because it's difficult to imagine a world without traffic and it's not going anywhere, so why waste your emotional energy on something that's not going to happen? So it doesn't come up. When I ask a more leading question, what do you think of guns, then people generally would say, well, I think it's crazy, you know, there's too many of them around, it's too easy. They would evoke the ancient art of pugilism. You know, in my day, we would settle them with our fists and so on. But with the open-ended question, no, it doesn't come up. I get that, actually. I do get that. And particularly with the Second Amendment, when I was promoting the book last year, quite often the Second Amendment would come up in radio call-ins. And I would emphasize, look, this is not a book about gun control. It's just a book that is made possible by the lack of gun control. So I'm not going to argue with you about scripture, which is essentially what the Second Amendment is. You just have to talk to me about how we keep these kids alive and how I keep my kids alive in a country where 7 children are shot dead every day. Or do you love that amendment more than you love your kids?
And what would they say?
A range of things, few of which to me were plausible. Well, there were arguments which I disagree with, but I think, you know, I can engage with. You know, it's about parenting. It's not about guns. It's you know, lack of morality and all. And to that, I would always say, I don't think that American parents are worse than parents anywhere else in the Western world. I don't think American kids are worse than anywhere else in the Western world. So it's got to be something else. one gentleman said, well, look, if you took a few cities out of the country, then this number goes way down. And I said, well, if you took Chicago and New Orleans and Newark and if you took those out of the country, but then where are you going to get your jazz from? Where are you going to get your blues from? Where are you going to get a range of things that make America what it is? And so people kind of actively try and imagine America without these people and the places that they live. And in a sense, that's the kind of heartbreaking thing, the degree to which people will seek to dismiss these deaths as being the function of some kind of death wish culture, which I just don't think it is. I think Americans like life as much as anybody else anywhere else in the world.
You wrote in here that you felt like you had to scream every day that you were working on this book. Was it worth it?
It was definitely worth it for me. It was the last thing I did. I reported from America for 12 years, and this was the end of this time. I learned a huge amount about the country doing this, and you can get quite jaded, particularly on something like this, where there would be a mass shooting, and I would be called, Gary, there's been a mass shooting, go to Virginia, Aurora, Red Lake, Minnesota, you run out of adjectives, you run out of metaphors, and, after a while, you're like, what do you want me to do? And so to kind of deep dive in the way that I did, and to struggle with some of the explanations, and to think, well, where's that coming from? What does that mean? To kind of terms that I have used often, like gang related, and then to kind of see the lives of these kids and think, well, that's not actually telling you very much. If you grew up in that block or that project, whatever, then everybody in that project is gang related. I mean, just by fact that you live there, and it's no more meaningful than saying, well, he was a communist, and because, if they live in China, when you're surrounded in the way that you are, in a gang-controlled area, then you have a relationship to that gang, even if that relationship is that you're not in it. I discovered that black fathers are more likely to bathe their children, change their children, read to them, put them to bed, than any other race of father. And I thought, well, that can't be true. Because I thought I knew. And then you think, well, hang on, you do those things. And I married an American. As I said, I have American kids. I thought I knew the country. And in a range of ways, this book showed me how much more there was to know and how some of the things I knew were far more interesting than I ever realized.
Do you feel like you have come to different conclusions?
I have a bit. I mean, I do think that my relationship to the gun control issue has become more complicated insofar as anything that they could do to reduce the number of guns in society would be a good thing, I believe. If more guns make you safer, then America should be the safest place on earth, and it's not. But I did, by the end, think it's more than that, that America needs a different story for itself that isn't about conquering and domination and masculinity and homestead and small government and rugged individualism, because all of those lead to the gun. And America's not alone in having those. Britain is in the process, thanks to Brexit, of finding out how small it is as a country. It's a long time coming, and it's an unfortunate way to find out, but that being small but having an empire and then being in the European Union and having a special relationship with America and all of those things have given Britons a kind of different sense of who they are, somewhat puffed up. Well, now we are finding out how small we are. Every country has its own myths, and some of those myths are deadly, and this is one of them, I think. So it changed my thinking about that, and it gave me some sense, therefore, of why, whatever the next one will be, why nothing will happen, because those myths will endure long after the pictures of the grieving people have gone. The other thing I would say, this is less, you know, pleasant, was the degree to which people really, in order to dismiss these deaths, or in the process of dismissing these deaths, actually strip the dead of their humanity. When I started, I thought, well, obviously, segregation is a barrier to empathy. You know, well, I don't know those people, so kind of there's less reason why I should care. That's normal. But by the end of it, I thought that some people thought this wasn't just happening to people unlike them, but it was actually not happening to people at all, but to a different kind of species. And that species was one where parents didn't love their children and children didn't love life, and where parents were negligent and children were feral. And so everybody was working on a different kind of premise in which the value of life was diminished, which is just simply not true. I mean, my experience of meeting the families and talking to them, it's not true. They knew their kids, they loved their kids, they wanted their kids to live, and one of the things that hurts is the notion that their child was removed from the planet and it didn't seem to challenge anything about how America thinks about itself. If anything, it just confirmed it.
Nothing changed, including attitudes.
Right. Nothing changed, and kind of worse than that, in a sense, when people heard, oh yes, in Pleasant Grove, Dallas, or in this, they thought, well, that's what happens down there. So it actually confirms what they thought. In 2002, I interviewed Maya Angelou, and she, referring to 9/11, she said, well, everybody was shocked, everybody was stunned, but African Americans have been living in a state of terror in this country for several hundred years. And so the idea that something like this might happen, not this in particular, but something so, is not so counter to, you know, what we've experienced. I thought it was interesting, and I put it in my piece, but I didn't really understand it until I'd written this book and realized and empathized as a parent with the idea that these parents are walking around not worrying, will my kid go to college? I hope he or she meets someone nice. You know, what will they wear to graduation? But will my child stay alive? Will my child stay alive?
Do you have any hope that it will change? I mean, like you say, you have American kids. Your wife is American. I assume even though you're back in Britain, you'll be visiting family and that sort of thing. I mean, do you hope things change? And if so, how do you see it changing?
I don't see the roadmap particularly. I say in Britain when, because nobody else gets this. So, you know, the book's been translated into French and Dutch. And so I've done events elsewhere, and people say, well, do you think they can change? And I say, look, with my tongue half in my cheek, they elected Barack Obama, and then they elected Donald Trump. And that means they can do anything that they put their mind to. For a country that has done so many things, one must believe that they could do this. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
Do you think it's probable?
No, I don't. But an awful lot can change in a place in a quite quick period of time. Americans aren't any dafter than anyone else in the world. If everybody else can get it, Americans can't get it. The question is, what will it take? And the reason why I don't think it's probable is if Sandy Hook didn't do it, then one wonders what event, you know, will do it. And also, if we look at, I don't know, what's going on with Harvey Weinstein and all of the stuff, that suddenly things unravel, and things unravel at such a pace and in such a way that kind of within months one can move what should have taken years can move in months.
So we can hope.
There's always hope.
Well, Gary Young, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Young is the editor-at-large for Britain's The Guardian, and he is author of Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. He was in Milwaukee last month to speak at Cardinal Stritch University, and we spoke with him then. You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at wuwm.com.